The next matter on for oral argument this morning is State of Minnesota v., I'm going to try to pronounce this, I'm not sure if it's Tyne or Tennis or Tynes. Case number is A180442. Council, as you're getting situated, I'll just remind you of our rules. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you choose to use that time for rebuttal. The timing restrictions are indicated in the lighting system in the podium with a clock, and please be mindful of those restrictions as you're presenting your arguments. And there's a button in the front of the podium. If you're not familiar with it, you can raise or lower the platform to your convenience. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name's Deborah Ellis, and I represent David Tynes. Mr. Tynes was convicted following a court trial in Hennepin County of hiring or agreeing to hire a prostitute between the ages of 13 and 16 and electronic solicitation of a child to engage in sexual conduct. The Honorable Paul Scoggin issued verdict and findings of fact as required under the Rule 2601. We'd submit that the court's findings of fact are internally inconsistent, and the circumstantial evidence of Mr. Tynes' belief with respect to age of the person that, or persons, that he was communicating with by text, under the circumstances presented an ambiguity and rendered the evidence insufficient as a matter of law to sustain those convictions.
Okay, I have an overarching legal question here. So usually we get these circumstantial evidence case challenges in the context of a jury. Here we've got an actual bench trial with an explicit finding as to credibility. So the district court found, as a factual matter, Mr. Tynes was not truthful in his testimony about his belief in the victim's age. So in this case, isn't that a circumstance proved that your client's statement that he didn't know or wasn't reasonably aware of the victim's age, a circumstance that has been proved?
I do not believe that it is a circumstance that has been proved. He did not find that he was untruthful. He said it was not credible. And I think that that's where, when you look at the actual findings, there is a benefit to the court, because the court found that the statement, "I'm almost 16, was lacking in any ambiguity, and then ignored the fact of what the ad had said before that and the conversation, long conversations, text messages that had preceded it.
Do you agree that the district court's finding that your client lacked credibility on that issue is a circumstance proved?
Not a circumstance proved, actually a circumstance that is not supported by the record, and if this court does its own independent, complete review of the circumstances, I think that the court will find that it's inconsistent because...
But if it were supported by the evidence, would that be a circumstance proved as a matter of how we look at the mechanics of a circumstantial evidence review?
If it was supported by the evidence. Right. But where I think the problem is that the court credited Mr. Tynes' testimony in a number of manners and then just, without any explanation, took the one statement the circumstance of him showing up at the location he'd been directed to as, you know, totally proving the intent. But in fact, I mean, the court said that it found that the business that Mr. Tynes walked into was deceptive and full and puts credibility into the statement of almost 16. So when the court finds that this whole business is built on deception, and further that Mr. Tynes was basing his conduct on past experience, the court is crediting that he had past experience, and he had testified in his past experiences, he had shown up at places. It was like an online dating where you don't know what is going to be behind the door. You don't know the age, the appearance, anything of the person. So he had shown up a number of other times and walked away. So when the court decides to credit Mr. Tynes' past experience and the fact that the court said that Mr. Tynes expected this to be like other past experiences, then it is inconsistent to say that he was absolutely sure when he showed up.
Well, not absolutely sure. You just have to be have a reasonable belief.
Have a reasonable belief.
So let me ask you this about on that issue, on the mens rea. What reasonable inferences can be drawn from Mr. Tyne's, about his belief? What reasonable inferences can be drawn about his belief in the victim's age from his text message that says, I'm going to quote here, "No thanks, please don't text me," immediately after she said she was almost 15.
Right, and he testified that when he read that, he said he wasn't interested in anyone that was under age 18, and he wasn't interested in anyone who was purporting or pretending to be under age 18 or who was playing games. And not only, I think what's very important, it's not only what Mr. Tyne said about this industry and his experience of people misrepresenting their appearance and their age, but the police officer, the detective who was involved in the texting, at page 63 in the transcript, he acknowledges is in that trade, you can't rely on what someone said. So Mr. Tynes, having seen the ad that says 18 in two different places, says that there's a very mature, sexy, and sensual, and compassionate woman who wants to have fun, and also says two girls available to generous men. So as he testified, when he hears this underage and he's not interested and thinking that someone's playing, he's already in the car, he's already driving to the location because what he was interested in and the offered price had already been discussed. He's driving to the location and then there is this text, I am younger than I had said. And he said, no thanks. He said then he continued to the place not knowing whether that was actually a fact or if there were and there are other people that were present.
So, Ms. Ellis, the fact that troubles me when trying to think this might be kind of a reasonable hypothesis is the text where he earlier says, I would love to see you for an hour. He doesn't see you and a friend or you and somebody else.
Well, I mean, he wasn't looking perhaps for two people at that time, but I'm looking to see you. I mean, who is the you, and how many people are doing the texting? I mean, there's a suggestion that he's having communication with one person, but who knows? I mean, there's no face-to-face, there's no photographs, there's no conversation, there's no voice. So, yes, whoever responded to him by text, he said, I'd like to see you. And so he wasn't indicating that he was looking at that time to have an interaction with two people, for example, at the same time. But the ad clearly indicates that there were at least two and perhaps three if you look at the very mature woman, and then also that there are two girls available for generous men.
But is there anything in the text exchanges or any other communication between these two that, and I believe it was all done by text, that would have would leave the fact finder with the conclusion that there was a contemplation of a liaison with more than one prostitute?
No, there's nothing that, I mean, I think that they're putting the burden back on him, like, why didn't you ask about the other ones? Why didn't you do this? I think what is interesting here in this case, that is different than many of the other cases, is that the only mention of almost 16 is one way, and there's no follow-up, like, are you okay with that? And when he says, I'm here, there's not a follow-up in saying, okay, so you're okay with me being 16?
Well, there is a follow-up. There's the I'm almost 16 response, no thanks, don't text me.
Right.
And then there's a re-engagement and a willingness to meet with her. So why isn't that a response to the indication of her age?
It's not a response and a play into the actual age because it's only a suggestion that that is an age, and that's been his experience in the past, that people are older than they say they are, that it is a ploy and that they use it to try and entice people in, that I'm younger, I'm sexier, and so therefore, you know, more likely to get the person to show up. One case that was recently decided by another panel in this court was Jewell. and that was decided, I think, towards the end of November. But in that case, where there is a discussion and a finding that there was solicitation of someone under the age of 16, there is extensive discussion back and forth about age. And the girl says, well, my mom is working, I'm home, I'm 15, is that okay with you? And he says, yes. And I mean, there's back and forth. There's never any confirmation from Mr. Tynes that, yes, I'm interested in you as a 16-year-old. No, based upon his prior experience, he was willing to show up and find out what was behind the door, who was there. And his past experience was that there would be discussions, perhaps, about a contract or what was going to happen, but nothing was final until there was a face-to-face and money exchanged. And as he testified to, and nobody undisputed that, that he had in the past much experience with prostitutes, he had walked away, and no one impeached him with the fact that, no, you've never done that. There was no Spriggle evidence. So when we are going to...
I thought he said he walked away. Forgive me if I'm misunderstanding the record. I thought his representations that he walked away when he arrived at these liaisons in the past was because of the lack of physical attraction to the prostitute. They had misrepresented with a photograph, and he was disappointed and left without engaging. Am I misunderstanding the testimony?
That's true, but he also testified that he showed up at places where the person appeared to be underage, and he didn't feel safe, and he didn't feel comfortable, and he actually asked for identification in those circumstances. So I think it was clear that, yes, Mr. Tynes was interested in engaging in prostitution on this particular day, but there is no indication that he was interested or pursuing anyone who is under the age of 16 or under the age of 18. And the fact that he shows up and is curious and wants to find out what's behind the door, what is this real situation, after he has had some discussion about full sex for 1 hour for 180 and directed to a place, while he's in the car, there are text messages and he's responding by voice. He shows up and says, I'm here, I'm going to find out what the circumstance is. This is an inchoate crime, and I suggest that if we are going to allow convictions to stand for an inchoate, which is like an anticipatory offense, then there should be no doubt whatsoever about all the elements having been met. And in this case, there's clearly questions about whether he intended to follow through with a person who is under the age of 16.
Ms. Ellis, did you make oral closing arguments to the district court?
I did not. I was not the trial counsel.
I see. Did trial counsel make oral closing arguments or in writing or otherwise?
Oral closing arguments. And I think they're both sides followed up with some written ones.
I mean, I'm not having read that transcript. I suspect that those arguments are similar to what you're saying right now. It seems like you're re-arguing the case, or you're arguing factual issues that were presented to the district court. The district court made findings of fact contrary to those. If we give heavy deference to a district court's credibility determinations, what's left? I mean, what can you argue to us that hasn't already been, that's not encompassed by the district court's credibility determinations and its very specific findings of fact?
Well, I would say if we looked at the conclusions of law, paragraph 2, where the court relies on Mr. Tynes' own testimony and that he established that he had frequently hired women to engage in sexual penetration and that he expected this transaction to be the same. So when the court credits Mr. Tynes' prior experience and what his expectations are, then it is totally inconsistent to say that the little notation, almost but not yet 16, dispensed with any reasonable ambiguity. That would be inconsistent totally with crediting what Mr. Tynes testified to based on his experience. So I think that the court's, just blatant, I don't find him credible, when the court has acknowledged that the ad was, I'd say conflicting, and I can't remember exactly where the original ad was contradictory, veiled, and existed in a marketplace filled with deception. So that is...
The original ad was, but do you see any ambiguity as to the victim's age in the text message exchange between the two?
It is just a statement by a person that, assuming that it's not a decoy, it's just somebody in the market who is looking to add some fluff.
No, I understand the argument about that. My question is there any ambiguity as to the victim's age in the text message exchanged between the parties?
Well, there's no ambiguity in what the actual words are, but what it actually means would have to be viewed, I believe, in context of the entire trade and taking into consideration also what the detective acknowledged was the deceptive practices in the trade. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for the state.
May it please the court, my name is Jane Burdorf. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I do represent the state of Minnesota. What Mr. Tyne's argument essentially is reject the traditional standard of review. District courts get to make credibility determinations about what evidence they believe and what witnesses they believe. The district court here did that, didn't believe Mr. Tyne's when he said he thought the person that he was engaging for prostitution was over the age of 16.
Is our review different in a circumstantial evidence case that involves a bench trial with specific findings than our review for a general verdict challenge with the jury?
The general standard review is the same. The benefit of a court trial is that you have specific findings. Here you know what the circumstance proved is because the district court told you. When Mr. Tyne said he believed that the prostitute he was or the fictitious prostitute he was engaging with was over the age of 16, the district court had the opportunity to see that testimony, assess his demeanor, and found him not credible. That is a circumstance proved, that the testimony, that belief is not credible. And the district court also gets to weigh the evidence and can believe parts of Mr. Tyne's testimony and disbelieve other parts. That's just standard appellate practice. That is the standard of review that this court has accepted.
I had similar questions to Judge Ross, and I was wondering whether it also the district court's specific findings might also factor in at the second step of the test, that the last step where the appellate court must determine whether there are any rational hypotheses that are consistent with innocence. It seems to me that if the district court has already ruled out some of those hypotheses, then they are simply not available for that argument.
They're not rational. I actually cited a case in a footnote in my brief. It's called State versus Hughes. That actually demonstrates that point, is when you're looking at circumstances proved and rational inferences, if a district court has specifically disbelieved an assertion, that can't be the basis of a rational inference other than guilt. So that's the citation in my brief. The state of
Minnesota. Minap, 1984.
Yes.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, I apologize for putting in a footnote. I just
no.
saw it again this morning when I was re-looking at the briefs.
Thank you for putting in your brief.
Certainly. So really our position is you should apply the appropriate standard of review to these facts, not reweigh the evidence that's been done by the district court, which is the appropriate place for that to have happened. And that you should affirm the district court's guilty verdicts on both counts. As to the second issue, obviously we did concede that the case does need to be remanded. We'd like the convictions to remain on the record and agree that a judgment of conviction on one of the two counts should be vacated. So we do think a remand is appropriate in this particular case, but the conviction should be affirmed. If you don't have any additional questions, I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Briefly. And given that this is a circumstantial evidence case, I believe that the court is required to independently consider all the reasonable inferences that can be drawn from the circumstances as to whether Mr. Tyne's believed that he was talking to a minor or that he appeared after he had been told almost 16.
If the district court... if the district court's finding regarding your client's credibility on that issue is supported sufficiently so that we wouldn't reverse the credibility determination. Do you agree with the state that that essentially ends our inquiry on both steps, on two steps, in the circumstantial evidence analysis?
If the court would find that the inference is supported by the record, and while there's some suggestion that, oh, maybe it was on demeanor or whatever, that he didn't credit that one portion of Mr. Tynes's testimony, there was no impeachment of him. There was no suggestion that he was anything but candid.
But district courts can do that, and fact finders do that, don't they, all the time? I mean, you wouldn't expect a fact finder to wholesale reject every bit of testimony from a witness. You might pick and choose, believing some but not all of the testimony. Why wouldn't the district court, sitting as fact finder, have that same prerogative?
Certainly, you know, what I think that with the findings of fact, that there should be some basis that the court would say why it is one thing that the court is not crediting when the court credits his experience and that he expected it to be the same as it had been in the past.
I thought the district court did explain. I thought the district court looked to the text and explicitly referenced the text in its credibility determination on the point.
The court quoted the text and said that dispensed with any ambiguity, but then said that Mr. Tynes was expecting this to be the same as it had been in prior experiences and credited his testimony and his experience. So there is, I think, a total disconnect, and it's totally inconsistent to say he expected it the same, he had all that experience, no one suggested that he made it up or that he was trying to, you know, bolster his credibility by talking about his past experience. So the court credits all that and then just says that I'm almost 16 dispenses with ambiguity.
Let me point you to the specific reference that I have, and so you can address it. This is in A3 in your brief, paragraph 2, under the specific findings of the court. Defendant knew he was dealing with a person under the age of 16. As discussed under count 1, the text messages captured in the exhibit, in exhibit 2, make that clear. It seems as if the district court was explaining the basis of its credibility determination.
And I'm sorry, what?
I'm sorry.
Okay, page 3 of the court's order.
Yes.
Talking about what his intent was to arouse desire in a person, and he was interested, of course, in hiring a prostitute, all the discussion about full service, and it was that before any mention of anyone being under the age of 18. And then, and that he was sexually ready, I mean, indicates that he was, again, intent upon engaging in prostitution. So I don't see that that clearly supports the conclusion that almost 16 dispensed with any ambiguity. And again, it's in the context of the ad, his past experience, and even what the officer said was the deceptive practice in that industry.
Which case in your research have you found that is closest to this one as to establishing what is necessary for an appellate court to reverse a district court's credibility finding or a fact finder's credibility finding, whether it's the court or a jury?
I would just have to say that the Harris case says that the court is to independently review all the circumstances when circumstantial evidence is the basis for the conviction or any particular element. And I think that the court's findings here give this court a window into what made up that determination, which is, I think, totally inconsistent, internally inconsistent.
Is it fair to say, well, from listening to your oral argument, I get the sense that your brief is phrased in terms of the evidence in the record is insufficient. I think what you're telling us today is that you think the findings of fact are erroneous. That's two different ways to go about it, but if you could establish that one or more findings of fact is erroneous, and then if we remove the erroneous finding, then it could be that what's left, you know, the remaining findings don't support the verdict. But But in your brief, you seem to be focusing on whether the evidence supports the findings, I think.
I think that when there are findings of fact that, and the verdict, it is an attack on the verdict, but in particular, the one element of whether he reasonably believed that the person on the other end. So I guess I get to the same point, whether it's undermining the conviction or undermining that one element of knowledge.
Well, thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. Thank you for being so prepared today for the arguments and for presenting your cases very well. Both clients should be very pleased with their representation today. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you.